Well, hello everyone. Welcome back to A Basic Conversation. My name's Brad Rieger. I'm the host, and as always, I'm sitting across from our resident theologian, Father Jim Basic. Father Basic, good to be with you again today.
Same, Brad. Let's do it.
Let's do it. And today's topic is sexual morality. And before we enter into this conversation, maybe a couple caveats are worth mentioning. So I'll throw out a couple, and you can add to whatever you think. So first of all, two men speaking on the topic of sexuality with no female representation is inherently dangerous, right?
True.
So let's just acknowledge a one-sidedness.
I'll hear from people.
Yes. A second caveat would be a strong argument can be made that men, we are the cause of much of the distress associated with sexuality. And if we just look at the Me Too movement and the really graphic, horrific stories that continue to come forward, there's much for us on the male side to be reflective on. And I would say the third caveat, Father Basic, is just kind of the Catholic Church and the sex abuse, and some of the moral authority has been tarnished in that area.
So, oh, that's such an important point, Brad. Yeah, moral authority tarnished for sure. And we got one more problem. We got one guy who's married and has kids and knows what it's like. Now you got dealing with a celibate priest. My sister always says, "Well, what do you know about it?" So, with all those guys, but I know it. The question, the topic, from the viewpoint of problems, that people have come to me with problems, and I will be feeding back what I've heard from them essentially. And I'll also be guided by moral theologians. I'm what we call a systematic theologian. We have another group of people that deal with moral matters called moral theologians. So I'll be drawing on some of those people, Tim O'Connell, Margaret Farley, and people representing the Catholic Theological Society, moral theologians. So I'll be drawing on them for insights to deal with the problems that I've encountered my whole priestly life.
Yeah. So to get to the problems or issues, and they're pretty heavy in nature, we're not going to use real people. Obviously, we're going to do some make-believe scenarios that are based in real-life experience.
Okay? For sure, yeah.
All right. So let me start, and I'm basically copying some of your technique that you've used in various speeches and lectures. So how about the first person is Abraham?
Yeah, I use biblical figures very often. So Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Rachel. Those are the names.
So. You're right on.
That's a way for me to remember.
Those are the scenarios we're
going to
be.
So what about Abraham?
So Abraham, he's a college student and he's wrestling with an addiction to pornography.
Yeah. And problem of masturbation, yeah. So, and he's feeling guilty about it. He's been dealing with this problem all the way along the line. He's tried various ways to get around it. He's gone to confession. He's sought advice. He's continued to go to Mass regularly. Sometimes he doesn't feel like he's worthy to go to communion and so on. So, I mean, this is a real problem. I would say he's analysis that he's addicted to pornography and he's has a long-time habit of masturbation. So that I can't tell you how many times that story has come my way. And so what am I going to tell Abraham? You know, one of the first things I'm going to say to Abraham is I think we've got to get around the problem of guilt. I think we don't want to see this as a problem of sinfulness. I think we want to see this as a psychological problem, as a habit, and so on. As long as you're going to keep thinking of it in terms of sinfulness, Abraham, I don't think we're going to get any place. So I want to change the framework for discussing it. And I want to see this as a question of of trying to find sexual maturity. Like every human being, we have to grow and develop in that way. And so first thing I got to get, let's get rid of this idea of it being sinful. Because here's what your pattern has been. How can you go to confession on Saturday and then go to communion Sunday, and then Monday you masturbate while watching pornography and you think, well, now I'm going to hell. We have in moral theology, we talk about a fundamental option. Fundamental option says that all of us are either poised to do good, or all either desiring to be with God, or we're desiring selfishness and going on. Now, it's clear to me, Abraham, that you fundamental option is for God. You're trying to do good. You go to church, you pray, and all of that. So it's not possible, in my mind, to think of, or the line of moral theologians, or the Catholic Catechism, by the way, to think that you are just going back and forth between sinfulness and grace, between being close to God and in danger of going to hell on a weekly basis. It just doesn't make any sense in terms of your fundamental option is for God. So we got to figure out how you're going to make progress in dealing with this addiction and long-standing habit. Incidentally, even this is modern theologians, contemporary moral theologians talk like that. But so does the Catholic Catechism, which says that the guilt involved with masturbation is dependent in many ways on habit and on psychological problems. So don't we got to get rid of that. So now what we got to do is see you in a process of trying to become a mature sexual person. One thing you might try is developing a fundamental respect for women. So those women you're watching in the pornography are people, they're persons, they got feelings. You know, they're trapped into their existence. They have a mother and a father. They're called by God to holiness as well. So women are persons. Mm-hmm. Women are not sex objects, so maybe that's gonna help. I think another thing that would be important to you as you try to deal with this problem is to be patient with yourself. You're probably not going to get over this habit tomorrow. You know, this is going to take some time. And one of the things I think will help you is to develop good female relationships, to have women that you can talk to, real flesh and blood people, maybe not romantic, just friends or acquaintances or fellow students and so on. You know, so to get to know women and to see them as people that you can have a conversation with, that you could go to a concert with or do other things with. So that's the direction. We're getting past sinfulness. We're trying to deal with an addiction, which is hard, very difficult. But I think that it's possible for you to make progress.
Right. All right, so moving on from Abraham, we have Sarah.
Yes.
Sarah's a collegian, and she's wrestling with whether to move in to live with her boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
And then on a deeper level, even the appropriate level of sexuality associated with the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's common enough problem today, right? Whether she could move in. So I got questions for Sarah, you know. How committed are you to this man that's inviting you to live with him, move into his apartment with him? How much commitment? Are you in love with him? Probably not. No. Are you totally committed to him? No. I still have my eyes open to other guys and other opportunities and so on. What will your mother think about this, your parents, if you decide to move in? Is that going to make your mother have a heart attack? Or your dad to be really upset and want to go beat this guy up or something? How upsetting is that going to be? How does this stand with your conscience? Do you think you will feel guilty if you do it or not? Well, Sarah, in listening to your story, it's pretty clear you're not totally committed. You're not ready to make this the man of your life. And So to move in and have a regular sexual relationship, I think, is not being honest with yourself. Mm. I don't have, a lot of times I leave people and say, well, make up your own mind. I got a clear idea. Don't move in, Sarah. I don't think you should do that. You're not ready. It's going to mess up your own personal sexual development, and you're in great danger of being used by this guy. So, you know, sexuality's got a social dimension to it. What people think about sexual behavior is important. What your family thinks, what your church, your Catholic upbringing tells you, don't do that. So don't do it.
Gotcha. Third scenario, situation involved Isaac. And Isaac is a young married man, or maybe even a middle-aged married man. And when he was a young person, he was part of the hookup culture.
Yeah.
Frequent sexual partners, sex was good.
Right.
He marries someone, they're in love, and a couple kids come along, and the sex in the marriage is not as fulfilling or as exciting to Isaac, and he's concerned about that.
Well, let's go back to the hookup culture, which is still so common on the college campuses. Fundamentally, it involves casual sex with no direction, no commitment. We also had the phenomenon what we call friends with benefits on common. I mean, that was a lot of people, and I think Isaac is another thing, ended up finding the sexual encounters to be empty. Common word. In fact, we got a lot of major studies still going on now about people coming out of the hookup culture. They say the sex was empty. It didn't mean anything to me. And it sort of spoiled my attitude towards it. There was nothing romantic about it. You know, you didn't give the girl flowers or something, or take her to dinner before sex. That wasn't necessary. She's just available to each other. Now, one of the things they used to have on campus were parties where males and females came together. And like one example is that a party is the guys come as golf pros and the women come as tennis hoes. You know, euphemism for whores. They come dressed that way. And Isaac found that whenever he went to one of those parties, he came away with a sexual partner because the girls were there advertising themselves. I used to talk to some of the women who participated in that, and they said, well, you know, think about your mothers, grandmothers who fought so hard for sexual liberation and to be free and to be autonomous, and here you are playing into this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's a betrayal of a long tradition of women trying to get to be autonomous, trying to have their own life and not be at the prey of men like that. So Isaac, that's bad history for you. You left a lot of strewn bodies there, you know. You left a lot of behind of stuff that wasn't good. You need to be asking forgiveness for all of that, for the women that you hurt. And I think in general, the hookup culture is just not working. It's not creating people who are sexually mature. It's ruining friendships, friends with benefits. And again, there's a lot of polls showing that people feel bad about it, that it doesn't work. It's not, very few find it satisfying sex. Yeah, so.
How did that impact the marital love, though?
Isaac has found a girl that he could live with and love. And I think that they have every chance. I know Isaac, so. I think there's every chance that he's going to work that out, but he's got to come to terms with that. So his wife is not a friend with benefits. You know, his wife is not a sexual object. His wife is a partner. And The sexual should be mutual. Sexuality should be mutual. The love-making should be joyful and free and autonomous, pleasurable, mutual, engaged in mutual. So he has to work at it, but he's got a good partner, and I think that they'll be able to work it out. I got good hopes for
good
Isaac.
Good faith for Isaac. All right.
Yeah.
A similar scenario involving Rebecca.
Yeah.
She got married, and sex isn't great for her either.
Yeah.
So, and we can parlay that with a theological, theology of the body.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that, the John Paul II gave a series of lectures over many years, 129 of them, I think, on sexuality and the forms what we call the theology of the body. And John Paul II was, very positive about sexuality. Not that the young people have to know it's a good thing. I don't think they need reminders of that. The culture's got that pretty straight. And the fundamental goodness of the human body. But many of us see in moral theologians, the moral theologians who are married, like Rick Gallardi, my friend and theologian, say that John Paul II's stuff was unrealistic, overly romanticized. So her fundamental problem is she listened to priests, celibate priests, to talk about sex, or listened to a celibate pope. The theology of the body is very popular. When I would teach students, that's one thing that the freshman students knew about church teaching was sexuality of the body, theology of the body. And there was a Christopher West who went around the country popularizing that. And so she was very aware of this teaching, and she had listened to Christopher West and so on. And so, and she's looking forward, she saves intercourse for marriage, she's looking forward to it, and well, it's just not that great. It's not, it's good, but it's not awesome. It's and there's a lot of other things going on. She's got kids now and so on. And her line is, to me, is, I must be doing something wrong. I must be doing something wrong, so I'm not living up to what Christopher West said about the theology, or Pope John Paul II said, how every act of intercourse would be a total self-giving. That's what John Paul said. Every act of intercourse is going to be total self-giving, and therefore it's, free of all demonic forces or selfishness and so on. Well, it just isn't like that, right? Mm-hmm. And all the married theologians, moral theologians, say that. It's her problem is she listened to the priest too much and set up unrealistic goals for marriage. So it's ordinary. So what? So maybe on your wedding anniversary, it's special. Maybe you got away for a weekend with your husband, and it felt special. But how about just living with it as ordinary? So, what was her name again?
It was Rebecca.
Rebecca. I'm telling you, you're not doing anything wrong. That's life. That's the limitations of life. In fact, in life in general, we never totally give ourselves. There's always some selfish. Albert Camus said that about Christians. Christians are not altruistic. They think if they're good, they'll get to heaven. So there's always some other thing. We're never totally pure in our motivation. So the act of total self-giving just doesn't happen in life or in sex. And yet we can be good, we can rise above selfishness. And so if you get rid of that, don't listen to the priest, listen to one priest, I'm telling you, your advisor. Let it be ordinary, enjoy it.
That's right. Let's go on to the next one, Jacob. And Jacob, at age 13 or 14, started to sense that his sexual orientation was different than his classmates. And then at around 18 years old, he came out as gay.
Yeah.
So now he comes to you with the general question, trying to figure out how to navigate life now that he's open about his sexuality.
Yeah, yeah. And he's upset with the church. Sure. He doesn't go to Mass anymore. He doesn't feel part of the community. He feels rejected. He's got in his mind a line that Pope Benedict said, and it's in the Catechism too, that being gay is a disordered existence. Mm-hmm. Disordered existence. In fact, all of his gay friends know that line. They don't know anything else the church said, but they know that the church says it's disordered existence, and it makes them feel bad. It makes them feel not worthy. And so he can't, you know, he's just negative on the church because of this teaching. So what do we do here? I think of so many young people I ran into like that, gay, lesbians. There's another way of possibly thinking about it, and that is that God made the human family. God made all human beings, and a certain percentage of those human beings are not heterosexual. They have same-sex attractions. And what, instead of saying God made something terrible, what about if we said God made something good? You know, God, this is part of God's plan. It's part of his salvation. God loves heterosexuals and homosexuals as equally. And so that it actually enriches. Think of all the gay people who have made great contributions in history. You know, that it actually enriches the human family. They're all better off because we have gay friends, women, lesbian friends. You know, that enriches our lives. It gives us another way of saying. Now we're running up against here, against official teaching. Got to say that.
Right.
Got to be honest about that. The official teaching is says it's disordered. Official teaching says that you can't, gay people can't get married, and so on. So I'd like to raise up Pope Francis in this regard. You know, so Pope Francis recently talked about that he thought that societies could legalize gay marriage, and that was an okay thing to do. He wasn't going to impose legalize. So in the United States, gay people can get married, right? And but the question becomes then, well, what does the church do about it? You know, one of the good things about our bishops in the United States, they've been very welcoming to gay people. You know, they have, you know, said we priests have to welcome them in the congregation. They should be lectors and Eucharistic ministers and participate in all the committees, and so that should be. And we should make sure they're welcome, and we know we respect them and love them. And so that's a good thing. That's a counterpoint to saying it's disordered. I think maybe somewhere along the line there will be further thought about whether we want to stay with that idea of disordered existence or not. I think there will be somewhere along the line where the church might want to rethink that. And again, Pope Francis saying, well, we're not against legalizing gay marriage. Now, our American bishops, again, are not with Pope Francis on that in general. They oppose abortion and gay marriage passionately in everything they say. And Pope Francis says, don't obsess over it. Don't obsess over abortion and gay marriage, you know. There's other things to consider. And so maybe our American bishops somewhere along the line, I don't know, would be more in tune with Pope Francis, who says he's got nothing against legalizing it.
Yeah. Father Basic, our last scenario or snippet is Rachel. She's in her 70s, and her marriage, her husband basically ran the whole show, very patriarchal setup, and a level of happiness to her. But then, you know, now thinking back, she's wondering, especially what to tell her daughters and grandchildren, and the famous Ephesians 5.
Yeah, scripture. Let's talk about that. That's important. And so later in her life, she's put up with this guy all these years. No, it's not all bad. They've had good right. times and gotten along, and a lot of times their sex has been joyful and good and so on. But looking back on it, she sees that he's run the show. No, he's been in charge of everything. Every major decision he decided. When they were young married people, he had job offers, and she was at a good job. He had a good job. He made more money, and whenever he got a job promotion, they moved. It wasn't, well, maybe we'll stay here because you like your teaching job. No, they moved. So every decision along the line finally rested with him. And she's seeing now, late in her life, that maybe she didn't serve him as well as she should have. She was acquiescent, she put up with it, she didn't challenge it or anything. And she doesn't want her daughters and granddaughters to fall into that same pack. When she was married, she chose Ephesians 5 as one of the, she chose it, which says, wives, be subject to your husband, be obedient. That came out of a patriarchal culture for sure.
Sure, sure.
Every wedding I had where people, the bride agreed to Ephesians 5, I felt there was trouble. I remember one very clearly, and I co-celebrated with the Protestant ministers who kept hammering a home, and every comment was, now you remember, you be subject to your husband. And every chance I got to talk, I said, now remember, there's mutuality, you know. So, you know, I mean, the Me Too movement, we're all learning more now about women's roles and so on, trying to learn, need to keep learning, as you pointed out. But she doesn't want her granddaughter, who's going to get married, to choose Ephesians 5. You know, choose the Song of Songs, where it talks about men and women sexual fantasies. And for the woman speaks first, my lover is like a stag bounding over the mountains. Oh, that's great poetry. That's in the Bible, so don't you choose Song of Songs. Where the woman's fantasies are taken seriously. Her beloved is a stag bouncing over the mountains and so on. So she wants that. So, and she represents, we got to get beyond patriarchy. And the church should be part of this. Unfortunately, very often we haven't done a good job with that. But, you know, I'd like to support the women who talk to me about the Me Too movement. And I think that to talk about one of the values in sexuality is autonomy, to be able to be in charge of one's own life, to have a mutual relationship, a partnership. It's great. In fact, the Bible again talks about Adam's looking for a suitable partner. Hmm. You're not looking for a slave. You're not looking for a clone. He's looking for a suitable partner. A suitable partner will have her own thoughts, her own ways, contribute to the marriage, and so on.
Well, we've had seven scenarios, seven deep topics.
Yeah.
Probably each one of them we could have expanded, but you've given us some really good kernels.
You know, I want to say about the video that we were bouncing off of. I think it's really good. Of course, it's my video. I mean, am I disinterested? No.
You brought your A game.
Yes, I felt very good about it. So if you like this podcast, in this case, you might want to go to that video and see an expanded, it's the same format, but expanded version. And I think said some things pretty well.
You gave some great, great kernels of thought and thought-provoking ideas, and just ways for us to help us grow in the area of sexuality. So, for the basic,
we all need to do that.
We all need to do that for sure. So, thank you.